Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Evoke Therapy Programs podcast. And we are continuing our series to talk with our therapists and give you guys an experience and some exposure to who they are and who they work with. So today, our guest is Jenna Pacelli. Thank you, Jenna, for joining us today.
Hi, Brad. Thanks for having me.
So glad to have you.
Yeah.
So I'd like to start off with kind of your background, how you got to this work, to this point in your life, and why wilderness?
Yes. Well, I was inspired listening to Lauren Roberts, her episode. So if anybody hasn't listened to hers, you know, of course, go listen to hers and all of our other amazing therapists. But she talked about going camping as a kid and not being raised by a family that was that into the outdoors. But they did, my family did do enough of it where I was camping as a kid and just loved it. And I remember eating way too many gummy worms and playing flashlight tag and feeling really free. And I think I always had a connection to nature in that way. So I would say that's maybe more of the nature side of, I don't know. It just seems to be wired into my makeup for some reason. And then when I was, 12, my younger brother, Corey, had to undergo heart surgery, open heart surgery. He was really young. And I don't think I understood the gravity of it, but I remember being really scared that day and worried about him. And again, I was maybe he was 9, I was maybe 12. Mm-hmm. And later on in high school, maybe I'll be a heart surgeon because that heart surgeon, you know, saved my brother and I want to help people. And I think only later on, and I'll tell more of the story as well behind that, why I didn't end up going the medical school route. But the idea that like I wanted to heal people. And later on, and this maybe sounds kind of cheesy, but I'm going to go with it, which is the idea that like I wanted to heal and fix hearts. And I think I'm doing that, but in a different way.
Right.
And
that's really cool.
Yeah. So there was that and going through my adolescence thinking about that. And then in college, I was, you know, as we do, we fall in love and I fell in love with this guy and he ended up dying tragically of heart failure, which is so interesting now that I'm putting the two together. They mm-hmm. both had heart issues. And he died suddenly and my whole life was turned upside down. I mean, I was at a very rigorous school for my undergraduate degree and I was studying medicine, like pre-med. I was pre-med. I was on the triathlon team. I was doing all the, you know, quote unquote, good things that we talk about, Brad. And I think you speak to this so often and I resonate with this so frequently, the idea that, you know, the idea of trying to be good all the time.
Right.
And where that originates from. And that definitely comes from my family of origin and trying to be, you know, what everybody else wanted from me, what everybody else expected from me without really giving it much thought. And so this, he died. And then I was like, what am I doing? And women or people who carry purses, I should say, will relate to this or any kind of bag where you've been carrying it around for a while. And over time, you create this like, there's like paper clips and crumbs and all and like old receipts and all these things that you don't need anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like these ways in which we get stale in our life, the ways that we get complacent, the ways that we forget who we are. I think it's like, we're just kind of skating by and that it's like that whole bag of mine just got flipped upside down and all the contents went everywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's how, and then I found, I was dragged to yoga with a friend and found mindfulness in a whole new way. And decided I was going to do something else with my life. And I remember having a stack of books. I love to learn, and I figured, well, I'll just try to learn everything I can about spirituality and where people might go after this. I was raised Catholic, and I'm going to look at all sorts of different ways of looking at this. And I remember having my head, like, you know, arms crossed, forehead on my arms on the table, sobbing, just not understanding why and how somebody could die so young. And just committing my life to making an impact. And so after college, I knew I wanted to do something with therapy because I had a really wonderful grief therapist that helped me. And I wanted to do something outside. And I did my wilderness first responder training, and Evoke was, or Second Nature at the time, was on there for a field staff position. It was wilderness and it was therapy. And I said, well, I don't know what this is, but I guess I'll try it out. And I ended up coming out for training and was a field staff right out of college. So that's kind of how I was, went that way.
And then you went back, and then you left, went back to school.
I left, went to India and Nepal for a little bit to study more yoga and meditation, came back, was doing transition coaching for people coming out of wilderness and other residential treatment. And I was teaching yoga full time in San Francisco and then decided to go back to graduate school.
So listening to you, I'm reminded of a couple of things, your passion and your ability to tell a really good story. So I know it's kind of out of order, but tell people, you're very active on social media and you share a lot of information, stories, wisdom on social media. So let's pause and just give you a moment to tell people where they can go if they want to hear more from you.
Sure. So it's Jenna Pacelli Therapy. And I think I've got dots in between the three of those just so you can read it. So it's jenna.pacelli.therapy. And that's my therapy account. So I post primarily therapeutic content. And then on Jenna Pacelli.
And that's on Instagram, right?
On Instagram. Thank you. Yes. And then Jenna Pacelli is more mindfulness and holistic health solutions and any kind of other thoughts that I have and some pictures of my dog.
Yeah. So you're kind of is a natural lead into my next question, which is your approach. Tell us a little bit about your approach to therapy and how that kind of fits with who you work best with.
So I love working with clients who are exhibiting some kind of disconnection from their body. So they're struggling to connect with the fullness of their experience. And that could look like depression, anxiety, addiction, maybe just failure to launch, which is like the idea that young adults are just struggling to get out there on their own. And I like to work with them on reconnecting to all of the parts of themselves. So getting them regulated, which means it's another way of looking at it. It's like a bottom-up approach. So I focus on regulating their nervous systems so that we can get the rest of their brain back online and functioning. So typically my clients have done a lot of therapy already. They've done lots of cognitive work, which is very valuable. And we do a lot of cognitive and a lot of behavioral work in wilderness. It's just inherent in the work. And I like to come in and add some things to that that maybe they haven't done before, because usually they're so bright. they've maybe ran circles around other treatment places, or they weren't ready for the clinical work they needed to do. And I try to get under the hood in that way. So for instance, I see a lot of adolescent girls who, or young adult women who are struggling with emotion regulation. So they struggle to stay in their bodies, to be in healthy relationships, to not using substances of some sort. They're doing something to numb out from their experience. And I see this as well with my young adult men and all the genders, but the idea that, you know, if I try to tell somebody who's totally dysregulated to get over it in one form or another, they can't process that, is my experience, right? The newest part of their brain, and I love neuroscience and I'm passionate about combining all of that together, but the neocortex, the newest, the outermost layer of the brain is not really functioning very well when they're really dysregulated. And we know this through research. So something that Bessel van der Kolk talks about in one study where, we remember 9/11 quite well. Most people do because there's enough adrenaline in the system and that can help form very clear memories. So, you know, we might remember what we were doing on 9/11, but we have no clue what we were doing on September 10th, right? Or September 13th, maybe more on the 13th because we're still stressed. But once those levels of adrenaline and cortisol reach a certain level, we're not processing anymore. The brain actually struggles to form memories. And this is why we can start to see the kind of convoluted nature of traumatic memory. And so we have to work in a different way. And it can feel weird at first because I'm asking them all sorts of questions about what's happening in their bodies. I'm asking them to combine sensation vocabulary with emotional vocabulary. And my belief is that weird just means new. So once they get used to it, they're able to find a much deeper sense of integration and healing.
Do you think that there's some common misperceptions about trauma?
Yeah.
The people out maybe in pop culture, pop psychology, that there's some misunderstandings.
Yeah, I do think there are a lot of misconceptions and misunderstandings, and thankfully, we are learning so much more about trauma. We have so much more data, and I want to credit some of the leaders in this field, which, you know, people like Peter Levine and Bessel van der Kolk and even Gabor Mate, who I'm going to talk about in a little bit. Like the idea that trauma, they all agree that trauma lives in the body, in the nervous system, and not in the story. So that's what they've found in their research. And that we will often recreate our past if we don't heal the way that trauma is living in our bodies. So there's that piece, that trauma is living in the body. And the idea that we have to know the story in order to heal it. Like I hear a lot of parents, you know, whose children have had maybe made accusations. So then we're in a legal situation and it's a lot more stressful and there is a need for some semblance of truth, right? But a lot of parents saying, we have to figure it out. And that's not always the case necessarily in order to help the person heal from trauma. So there's that. The other number two or three here is that we used to think that trauma was just what we called big T trauma. So things like car accidents, being in a war, natural disasters, severe abuse, neglect, death of a loved one, right? These big, obvious forms of trauma. And what we're understanding now is that trauma is an almost universal part of the human experience. And I think you've said, Brad, that we're going to dent our kids, right? Mm-hmm. We were dented by our parents and we're going to dent our own kids. And so the definition of trauma is significantly broadening. It's widening so much more. And we're understanding a lot more of people's behavior through this lens. So we also have what we call little T trauma. So things that are less obvious, like minor car accidents, falls, medical or dental procedures, like waiting to be left at school. I remember when I was left at school once at night, yeah. I was terrified. And feeling unsupported, a parent who's depressed, a parent who is anxious, a parent who breaks promises, a divorce, changing schools, not being picked for the team, even things like high fevers, other medical traumas, being bullied. The list goes on and on. And I think this is where we are starting to understand people's why people are behaving the way that they do, and why people are struggling to, quote unquote, that, you know, that's quote, like pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And that's really tough when you're struggling to just even regulate yourself, to even feel any semblance of some peace and clarity. So I would say those are the things that we misconceive, I think. And also that we, you know, that going towards the story over and over again is what's going to heal us. We actually need a really embodied sense of the work. And what I mean by that is integrating body and the brain. Because otherwise we risk re-traumatizing someone. And the idea that, you know, when somebody, that the nervous system and the body processes things a lot more slowly than our cognitive mind does, right? So it might feel like we're over it. You know, I hear this a lot from clients. Oh, I'm over it. I worked on that in the past. And yet they're still showing signs that they're not over it, right? Whether it's in their body or their emotions. So, yeah, so that's what I would say.
I mean, that brings me perfectly, I think, to the next question, which is one of the things that you've introduced me to, I haven't had a lot of exposure to in the past, is somatic experiencing. So can you tell us about how that works and how it's incorporated into your work with clients?
So somatic experiencing comes from the work of Peter Levine, and he spent years of his, you know, most of his life studying animal science. And what we, animal science and psychology, he's a psychologist. And what we know through that work is, and I'm going to tell a little story, and I love this video that I share. I share it with a lot of people, with families, with lots of people in the industry. And it's, so if we imagine there's a polar bear, right? There's a polar bear, and National Geographic is trying to study this polar bear. And they are coming after him in their helicopter, and this is extremely stressful for him. So what he, you're going to see him do, and you can look this video up, is you're going to see him, one, be running. So he is in a flight response. And then two, he's looking back at the helicopter. So he's, or it's an orientation response, and you're going to see a lot of different mammals doing the same thing and other animals. So he's running in a flight response, orienting, looking there, trying to understand what's happening. And then he's actually biting at the air, right? So that's his fight response. He doesn't know what else to do. He doesn't know what a helicopter is, but that's his brain's way of trying to process this information. And then they tranquilize him with the gun from the helicopter, and this puts him into an artificial freeze response. So we're looking at fight, flight, and freeze, which is the happens in the amygdala, which is a part of the brain that governs all of those processes. So anyway, so we have the idea that so what we're trying to do when trauma is happening, you know, actually, let me go back to that. So he's tranquilized, and then they take the tranquilizer gun out of him once they're done studying him. And he starts to convulse. So it can look like a grand mal seizure. It can look like just subtle trembling in the body. This is the nervous system discharging the energy. And then you see all four of his legs, almost like he's trying to run again, but he's still on his back. And his jaw starts to chatter because it's the completion of that fight response that was interrupted, right? And same with the legs. So it was the flight response was interrupted and the fight response was interrupted. Mm-hmm. And then he's discharging the energy. And then he walks, he goes on with his day, and he's fine. The difference between him and us, him and this polar bear and humans, is that we don't just allow, we for whatever reason, we tend to, because of our really powerful brains, we tend to override that completion response. and clamp down on it. So for instance, if I started shaking after a car accident, a lot of people would be like, don't shake. You know, that, oh, that's weird. Oh, there's mm-hmm. something wrong with me. Actually, that's a normal, natural response. And you want to let that happen. And so the idea of somatic experiencing is to allow somebody to complete their defensive responses that were interrupted, whether it was as an infant because mom was in her own depression, so sort of neglectful, she couldn't attune, so the baby just freezes, or they were overwhelmed because mom's really overly involved or erratically involved, like she's there and then she's not, right? And we see this in the human nervous system, and so we have to help people complete those nervous system responses, and then they start to feel a lot better. Mm-hmm. And so we look at things like the five areas of their experience, which is sensation, imagery, behavior, like movements that they might want to make, affect or emotion, and the meaning or the thoughts that they have about it, about whether it's this event or maybe they've got an emotional pattern that's stuck, right? They keep showing up the same way in relationships that they always have, and they don't know why, and they can't figure it out. And so we actually, when we can go into the body and rework some of those different channels of their experience, then we can start to fill in the gaps of their experience, right? So yeah, that I would say that's, yeah, did that answer your question?
It did.
Okay.
I actually love listening to it. I love listening to you tell the story.
Yeah. Cool.
You know, you've been trained in a lot of fairly unconventional and progressive ways, mm-hmm. and you like to weave in your training of neuroscience. Can you speak a little bit about the marriage, the bridge between those two things?
Yes. So I remember something that you said to me, Brad, was this idea that we have to educate people on what's happening in their brains as they're doing something new. You know, like what's going on? Why am I asking you to feel the sensation in your left arm, or mm-hmm. close your eyes, or breathe, you know? And so, yeah, I think that was a really valuable piece of advice that you gave me. And I've always loved the science, clearly. I mean, I wanted to maybe be a doctor, and then I love learning. And so combining all those together. So I, was trained at the California Institute for Integral Studies in San Francisco. And my master's degree, the long boring name is Integral Counseling Psychology, which is just a fancy way of saying we were trained to weave East and West wisdom into our work, right? So to look at the person as a whole being rather than being broken. I was trained to look at the world through a lens of social justice, of privilege, of activism. And I was taught, and I've always resonated with the idea that there are many paths up the same mountain, many ways of knowing and ways of understanding, and that everybody's life experience is their truth. And that when I honor them in their truth, they tend to heal themselves in large part. And so I find that psychology can be very much, and I'm going to use this word, spiritual path of self-inquiry, which just means like internal awareness and of self-actualization that can look like many things for many different people, right? And then I also, my undergrad degree was in anthropology, and I think some of the best education that I ever received was living and assimilating into other cultures, like when I traveled abroad or when I traveled through India and Nepal, and that deeply resonates with me. And then helping people understand why what's happening in their brain as they learn to be more in touch with their bodies. Something that I've been sitting with and thinking about too, is this idea of the adverse childhood experiences study, which Gabor Maté, who is an addiction specialist, and he works in he's a medical doctor, and he's one opinion of many, of course, but he's referenced this study, and it's a really groundbreaking study, which basically said that these ideas, the idea of adverse childhood experiences or ACEs, are potentially traumatic events that occur in childhood. So from birth or even in utero through about age 17. And so things like experiencing violence or abuse, a traumatic brain injury, fractures or burns, mental health issues like depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation, PTSD, whether it's in the child or in the parent. If the mother wasn't intending to become pregnant, there was pregnancy complications, or she's had a lot of miscarriages, the mother is like walking around with that trauma in her nervous system. Let's say like cancer or diabetes of a parent, alcohol and drug abuse, any struggles in education, occupation, and income. So things like that a lot of people experience are linked to chronic health problems, mental illness, substance misuse or abuse in adulthood, and that they can also negatively impact education and job opportunities later on. And thankfully, these adverse childhood experiences can be prevented. And what's fascinating, and this is maybe where the progressive or non-conventional part of me comes through, is something that Gabor has shared, was that this study was done at Kaiser Permanente in San Diego in conjunction with the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. And he went down to lecture their group of addiction specialists at Kaiser. And this was maybe 7 or 8 years ago. And he said, "So do you all know the ACEs study?" And they said, "No." And they didn't even know that this massively important study that basically links trauma with so many other difficulties in adult life, that had even been done at their one organization and two at their location. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the idea that we're still a little behind the eight ball here in terms of understanding how to help people that are either in poverty or experiencing discrimination, marginalization. And we see that like 61% of adults across 25 different states reported that they had experienced at least one type of adverse childhood experience, and then one in six shared that they had experienced four or more. Mm. Right, so we've got a huge epidemic here, and preventing these adverse childhood experiences, whether it's maternal or paternal education early in life, like helping parents parent better, helping parents with their own stuff, which is what you talk about all the time, could reduce a huge number of later health conditions. Right. So another stat here is that 1.9 million cases of heart disease and 21 million cases of depression could have potentially been avoided if they had prevented some of these ACE experiences. So it costs us a lot of money in our society, and we've got an issue, and I'm glad that we are also staying up to speed as well with cutting edge trauma research. So it's just clear to me that trauma creates such a massive ripple effect on people's lives later on, and that ACEs are common across all populations. It's not just ours. And they've redone this study over and over and over again. So,
I don't know if I've ever shared this with you before, but I borrowed it from somebody and she told me she borrowed it from somebody. The definition of trauma that she likes to follow that I've thought about ever since. And most people can be set back by this because it's so broad, but she said anything less than optimal.
Right.
And of course, more significant trauma, more chronic trauma is going to have more impact, but it gives us a compassionate perspective when thinking about somebody who's been hurt in any way and how to approach them with the kinds of things that you do in your work. So
right.
I just like that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We learn so much from each other, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So for the folks that are listening, Jenna, do you have some books that you like that you reference that might be helpful for them to understand more deeply the concepts that you're talking about?
Yes. Yes. So for parents, I would recommend Trauma Proofing Your Child by Peter Levine. I would recommend Parenting from the Inside Out by Dan Siegel. And then if you really want to get into it, The Body Keeps a Score by Bessel van der Kolk. It's a classic. And then for clinicians or referring professionals or whoever, you know, anybody in the industry, think books like Trauma Through a Child's Eyes, which was written by Peter Levine and Maggie Klein, and In an Unspoken Voice. So any of Peter's books and Bessel van der Kolk's books. And I think one more thing, Brad, if I may, I wanted to add one other piece about stress.
You bet.
You know, we're understanding that, for example, children whose parents are stressed are more likely to develop asthma. So because the stress, like the cortisol and the adrenaline, creates a constriction in the bronchial tubes, tightening them, creating asthma. So you see a lot more like inner city kids with asthma, right? Because parents are stressed. Parents are trying to survive, or any parent that's struggling. And you'll see that, just that physiological response. And so what we end up doing is suppressing the inflammation with, let's say, inhalers, which contain basically copies of adrenaline and cortisol. So we add more stress hormone into their system to try to make the inflammation go down. And so that's there's a lot of different ways to deal with that and to look at that and to say, you know, am I being served by what's going on right now? And looking at the parental emotional state and how that's connected to society and how is this parent being impacted by just the stressors of society in general, like even just being in a nuclear family, like not being as connected as we used to be, can create a lot of stress for parents. And then in the Eastern traditions, in the Eastern countries and spiritual traditions, we know that the heart center is connected to grief and to the breath. And so, you know, when I say heart center, I just mean what we would call a heart chakra, or it also corresponds with nerve ganglia, which are clusters of nerves in the body, and there's different ones throughout the body. And so, for instance, if there's grief, we know that it's very possible as well that people can develop breathing issues. So we're looking at it, you know, from the Western lens, from the Eastern lens, and understanding that every part of us is connected, and we have to look at the whole person, or hopefully look at the whole person, in order to help them really heal. So that's the other piece I wanted to add.
Very rich information. Thank you, Jenna.
You're welcome.
Speaking of stress,
yeah,
tell us about what you do away from work. What are your interests? What kinds of things you do for your own self-care?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I think this is always a practice for me. I'm not overly great at it, so I will say that. And it's an edge. And I love right now, I've been running a lot. I've been running longer distances, which I'm noticing resets my nervous system, and spending more time in meditation. That has been helping me also regulate myself. And I love my essential oils. I'm always using those. And of course, yoga practice, physical yoga practice, but a lot of it is meditation right now. So, and then of course, hanging out with my dog. I've got a big old Great Pyrenees mountain dog who comes into the field with me every week. So he's pretty fun.
Yeah, dogs are a big part of our family's lives. They sometimes they add to the stress, but over the big picture, they really do. They're very soothing to the nervous system for sure. So,
yes.
Well, Jenna, again, thank you so much for the information, for joining us. Thank you for and on behalf of the people that you work with, for the passion the energy, the intelligence you bring to the work. And I get to work with you. We get to work together later this week running an intensive, and you participated in those before. So I look forward to that.
Yes, yes. I'm so happy to be on the podcast and contribute in any way I can. And then I'm excited to get to share some of the things I like to learn about. So thanks for hosting.
Thank you, folks. Thanks for joining us. We hope these are helpful to give you a sense of the wonderful people that we work with here at Evoke Therapy Programs. And until next time, I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Talk.